Welcome back to the show, everyone. I'm Mia.
And I'm Milo. It's been one of those days where the whole AI ecosystem seemed to blink at once. So that's the thread running through today's episode. Capability, infrastructure, and what happens when all of it is suddenly load-bearing.
Right. We've got a benchmark-shattering model launch, a stack of simultaneous outages that might or might not be connected to it, big money moving into open models and open platforms, agent tooling with some awkward incentives, and then, mercifully, some science and history to cool things down.
Let's start with the launch that seems to have set everything else off. OpenAI released GPT-6 Astra, and the headline numbers are, honestly, hard to process. Frontier Math Tier 4 at 98%. That's saturation. Exploit Bench at 100%, and Arc AGI-3 at 99.9%.
And that last one is where the discussion got really interesting, because there are two very different numbers attached to Arc AGI-3. On the standard harness, Astra scored 62.7%, and that run cost about $26,000. But with something called a provider adapter, the score jumps to 99.9%. And the model beat humans on action efficiency, meaning it solved the tasks with fewer actions than people do.
Okay, so let's dig into that, because it's the crux of the whole debate. What is a provider adapter doing, and why should the gap between 62.7 and 99.9 matter so much?
The way the discussion framed it, the harness is the scaffolding you put around the model when you test it. How the environment is exposed, how actions are called, what information the model sees. A standard harness is meant to be the neutral, apples-to-apples setup. A provider adapter, apparently, changes how the model interfaces with the benchmark in some way that unlocks dramatically better performance.
And the split in the comments was pretty clean. One camp said, a score is only as meaningful as the harness it was measured on. If flipping the harness takes you from 62.7 to 99.9, then the 99.9 is measuring something about the adapter as much as the model. You can't compare that number to other models' standard harness scores and declare a winner.
The other camp pushed back and said, look, beating humans on action efficiency is a real result regardless. If the model completes Arc AGI-3 tasks with fewer actions than a person needs, that's a genuine capability claim. It's not like the adapter is solving the puzzles for it. Efficiency is the thing you'd expect a genuinely stronger reasoner to show.
There's also the cost angle, which people kept coming back to. $26,000 for the standard harness run. Someone made the point that at that price, benchmark runs are becoming their own kind of infrastructure investment. You're not just testing a model, you're paying for compute at a scale most researchers can't touch. Which raises the question of who even gets to verify these claims.
Right, and that connects to the deepest unresolved question in the thread. None of these numbers tell you how the model performs outside the benchmark environment. Frontier Math Tier 4 at 98? Impressive, but math benchmarks have their own distribution. Exploit Bench at 100? Again, saturation means the ceiling of the test is gone, not that the capability is unbounded. The recurring question was, what does Astra actually do on the messy, unmeasured problems people bring to it every day?
And OpenAI is also claiming better alignment this generation. Some commenters took that at face value. The models keep getting more capable, and the alignment work is keeping pace. Others were more skeptical, saying alignment claims are hard to evaluate from the outside, and a launch announcement is exactly where you'd expect the most favorable framing. There was no resolution on that. It's genuinely something you can't settle from a press release.
What you can observe is what happened to the servers. And that's our natural bridge here, because the Astra launch appears to have triggered, or at least coincided with, something unprecedented.
OpenAI, Claude, and Grok went down at the same time, simultaneously. And before anyone says coincidence, the thread laid out two main suspect theories.
Theory one, shared infrastructure. Cloudflare and Azure came up, the idea being that these services, despite being competitors at the model level, sit on overlapping layers of networking and cloud infrastructure. If a common layer degrades, everyone falls together. That's the boring but plausible explanation.
Theory two is the more colorful one, the migration cascade. The idea is that when Astra launched, huge numbers of users started switching tools at once, trying the new thing, moving their workflows, and that stampede of traffic and API churn rippled outward and knocked over services that weren't even the destination. Load cascades are a real phenomenon. A surge on one platform can destabilize dependencies elsewhere.
The Grok specifics made this more concrete. Grok had an outage on both the API side and the apps, while status.x.ai was itself reporting failures. So the status page, the thing you'd check to learn what's wrong, was also broken. HN commenters flagged the timing overlap with ChatGPT and Claude almost immediately.
And what was the tone of the discussion? I got the sense people weren't just joking about it.
Some were joking, sure. But underneath, there was a serious thread. If three of the biggest AI providers can fail at the same time, that tells you something about fragility that individual providers' uptime dashboards never will. People who build on these APIs were saying, essentially, the real lesson is that multi-provider redundancy is harder than it sounds when the failure modes correlate. Your backup provider isn't a backup if it goes down in the same hour.
Which nobody could confirm, to be fair. The root cause remains unknown. Both theories, shared infrastructure, migration cascade, are consistent with what was observed, and nothing in the reporting settles it. Some commenters held both at once, saying it could be infrastructure strain triggered by launch-driven load, which is really a hybrid of the two.
The unresolved part is that without a postmortem, everyone's reasoning from timing and vibes. And several people pointed out that this is exactly why independent postmortems matter. When the companies involved are also competitors, you're not going to get a joint, honest accounting unless someone forces it.
All right. From the fragility of the big labs, let's turn to the other end of the spectrum. Open models and open platforms, where there was genuinely big news on two fronts on the same day.
Yeah, and the juxtaposition is what made the discussion sharp. First, IFM launched K2 Horizon, an open fleet of six models ranging from 0.9 billion parameters all the way up to 375 bytes A to 3B, Apache 2.0 license. And crucially, they didn't just release weights, checkpoints, training data, and training code all out in the open.
That last part is what commenters kept emphasizing. Open weights have become fairly common. Open everything is still rare. With data and training code released, you can, in principle, reproduce the whole pipeline, study how the model was made, not just use the artifact. People called that the difference between an open product and an open science release.
The size range also got attention. A 0.9 billion model in the same fleet as a 375 bytes mixture. That's a deliberate on-ramp. Small models that run on modest hardware, stepping up to frontier class scale, all under the same license. Some saw it as a genuine attempt to serve the whole ecosystem, rather than just the top of the market.
Now the other half of the story. NVIDIA announced it's acquiring Hugging Face for $12.93 billion with the stated promise that the platform stays open and multi-accelerator.
And this is where the discussion got genuinely tense. The optimists said, Hugging Face becoming the neutral multi-accelerator hub under NVIDIA's ownership could actually be good. NVIDIA has every incentive to keep it the place where everyone puts models, and the multi-accelerator commitment suggests they don't want to wall it off to their own hardware, because the value of the platform is its breadth.
The skeptics were not convinced. The counterargument: $12.93 billion is not a donation. NVIDIA now owns the de facto distribution channel for open models, and whatever promises are made at announcement time exist in tension with the obvious strategic value of steering that channel. Several commenters said, "Watch what happens over years, not what's promised in the press release." De facto platforms have a way of drifting toward their owners' interests.
And the synthesis people kept reaching for. Put the two stories side by side, and you see OpenAI consolidating under big money from both ends. IFM is giving away the entire model pipeline, weights, data, code, while NVIDIA is buying the infrastructure where open models live. Open is winning, arguably. But who funds and controls Open is increasingly a very small set of very large players.
Someone made the point that Open and independent are becoming separate properties. K2 Horizon is Open and, today, independent. Hugging Face is Open, but no longer independent. The question going forward is whether the ecosystem can keep both. And nobody in the thread claimed to know the answer.
From platforms and money, let's come down to ground level. The tools developers actually use every day, and the economics and trust questions wrapped around them.
So first, Armature, a YC P26 company, measured about 17,000 sessions across Claude Code, Codex, and Cursor, and found something odd. Agentic coding tools rarely search the web, except Codex, which almost always does.
And the phrase that dominated the thread was conflict of interest. So let's unpack why a search pattern would be a conflict. The reasoning, as commenters laid it out, if your product's business model depends on keeping users inside your ecosystem, sending the agent out to the open web is a leak. The web is where the answers to many problems live: documentation, issue threads, library source. An agent that doesn't look is an agent constrained to what it already knows, which may be fine for the vendor and less fine for the user.
The counterpoint was that not searching isn't necessarily sinister. For many coding tasks, searching is wasted time. The model's training already covers the common cases, and web round trips add latency and noise. So one camp read the data as an optimization choice, the other read it as an incentive problem. And the Codex outlier is what makes the incentive reading hard to dismiss. If not searching were purely an optimization, why would one tool search almost always while its peers almost never do?
That divergence, to many commenters, was the tell. Same jobs, same users roughly, wildly different web behavior. Either Codex is dramatically over-searching, or everyone else is under-searching. And the 17,000 session sample is what gives the comparison teeth.
Second story in this cluster: Google Anti-Gravity's Terms of Service. They permit Google to suspend your entire Google account over suspected third-party use. Gurgly Oros flagged the risk publicly.
The word suspected is doing a lot of work there, and people noticed. Several commenters wrote versions of the same worry. Your Google account is often your identity, email, documents, two-factor anchors, everything. A term that allows suspension based on suspicion, not proven misuse, puts an enormous amount of your digital life at the mercy of an automated flag or a bad heuristic. And for developers experimenting with third-party tooling around a product, third-party use is a wide net.
The practical advice in the thread was basically, don't mix your mission-critical account with your experimentation account, which people found reasonable and also kind of grim, that the answer to aggressive terms is to fragment your own identity across accounts.
Third piece. Cerebras is serving Quinn 3.827 bytes on a public endpoint at around 1,500 tokens per second, and prompt caching carries no extra fee. Cached tokens are billed at the standard token price.
The speed number drew the usual awe, At 1,500 tokens per second, interactive workflows change character. The model responds faster than you can read. But the pricing detail is what the economically minded commenters latched onto. Prompt caching elsewhere is often priced with a premium or a discount structure that makes it its own line item. Charging cached tokens at the plain standard rate is simple. And simple pricing is itself a competitive move because it removes the mental overhead of optimizing your bill.
Common thread across all three: trust in economics of AI tooling. Armature's data asks whose interests the agent serves. Anti-gravity's terms ask how much power a vendor holds over your account. Cerebra's pricing asks what it actually costs to run models fast. Developers are increasingly making decisions on all three axes at once, not just raw capability.
And speaking of tools getting dramatically more capable, two stories that felt like previews of the near future. Polars 2.0 is in pre-release, and the headline is that the streaming engine is now the default, with roughly a 5x speedup.
The 5x got the attention, but the second part of the change is what experienced users were debating: stricter behavior in coercions and concatenations. In plain terms, Polars 2.0 is less willing to silently guess what you meant when types don't line up.
And the discussion split the way these discussions always split. The finally camp said silent coercion is how subtle data bugs are born. A string that quietly becomes a number, two frames that concatenate with mismatched columns, and nobody notices until the analysis is wrong. Strictness surfaces those errors at the moment they happen instead of three steps downstream.
The "this will hurt" camp pointed out that every strictness bump breaks working code, and there's a real migration cost. The moderate view, which several people landed on, was that this is the right kind of strictness precisely because it ships in a major version. 2.0 is when you're allowed to change behavior, and doing it while also delivering a 5x engine is about the best packaging a breaking change can get.
Then the story that broke a lot of brains. A developer ported a 1993 Amiga game to Godot in one night, using Claude Fable 5. The source was 72,758 lines of 68,000 assembly, and the game has been released for free.
72,000 lines of assembly in one night. The thread's reactions ran from, "This is the most impressive thing I've seen an AI do," to people trying to figure out what ported means at that speed and scale.
The charitable reading: assembly porting is, in some ways, a translation task. The logic is all there. The challenge is fidelity to the original hardware behavior, and an AI with the patience to grind through tens of thousands of lines without fatigue is well suited to it. A human expert doing this would take weeks or months. The bottleneck was never comprehension, it was throughput.
The more cautious reading asked about correctness. How do you verify that 72K lines of translated behavior are faithful? The answer, some noted, is that the developer had the game as a reference. You play it, you compare. For a game, behavioral testing is more tractable than for, say, a parser. And the fact that it was released for free suggests the developer was satisfied it worked.
The bigger point people drew: a night of work that used to be a months-long passion project. Between Polars making data pipelines 5 times faster by default and this, the theme was the same. Individual developer leverage is compounding fast, and the interesting question is what people do with a 100x lever.
Okay, deep breath. From AI leverage to things that have nothing to do with any of it, starting with a genuinely strange discovery on Saturn.
Astronomers, using Hubble, found a decagon, a 10-sided shape, at Saturn's south pole. It apparently formed around 2024, and it joins the famous hexagon at the North Pole, which has been known for decades.
The obvious question everyone asked: how does a planet grow polygons? The North Pole hexagon has been explained, at least loosely, as an atmospheric wave pattern, a standing wave in the jet stream at the pole. A decagon is a different beast. It's new, it formed recently, and 10 sides is a different regime than 6.
And the formed around 2024 detail is what made it more than a curiosity. The hexagon is long-lived and stable. A shape that appeared within the last couple of years means Saturn's polar dynamics are changing on human timescales, not geological ones. Commenters who knew atmospheric physics were excited because each new polygon constrains the models of how these standing waves form. Every additional shape is another data point in the puzzle of what determines the number of sides.
The unresolved question, of course, is why now? And why the South Pole? There was no answer in the reporting. It's a fresh observation. But the fact that it was caught by Hubble, an instrument that's been orbiting since 1990 and is still finding new things in our own solar system, got its own round of appreciation.
From planetary scale down to creek scale, and honestly, one of the most satisfying stories of the day. In California, artificial beaver dams on French Creek raised juvenile coho salmon survival from 8% to 60%.
Sit with those numbers for a second. 8% to 60%. From piles of wood and sticks that mimic what beavers used to do for free.
And the mechanism is beautifully low-tech, which is what commenters loved. The dams slow the water, create pools, restore the kind of habitat that young salmon evolved in. The fish aren't being helped directly. The environment is being restored to the state the fish were built for. Several people made the point that this is rewilding hydrology. Instead of engineering a solution, you're reinstalling the engineer, or at least its work product.
There was also the economics angle. Habitat restoration projects routinely cost millions, and here you get a 7.5-fold survival improvement from structures that cost, essentially, sticks. The caution some raised, French Creek is one site, and one success doesn't guarantee it transfers everywhere. Site conditions matter. But as a demonstration, it's about as strong as field results get.
Third science story, and my personal favorite. Three Irish teenagers tested 13,000 seeds over 3 years and found that Rhizobium bacteria sped barley germination by up to 50%. They won the Google Science Fair.
13,000 seeds over 3 years. That's not a school project. That's a proper experiment. The sample size is what made people take the results seriously. And Rhizobium is already famous in agriculture for its symbiosis with legumes, fixing nitrogen in root nodules. Showing it accelerates germination in barley, a grass, not a legume, is the interesting twist because it suggests a mechanism beyond the classic nitrogen-fixing partnership.
Which is exactly what the unresolved questions clustered around. What's the mechanism? And does it generalize beyond barley? The kids demonstrated the effect. Explaining it is a job for someone's lab. But multiple commenters made the same observation. At up to 50% faster germination, even a partial replication at agricultural scale would matter a lot. And it took teenagers 3 years and a lot of seeds to surface it.
The meta point in the thread, between a decagon forming on Saturn, beaver dams tripling plus salmon survival, and bacteria speeding up barley, the day's science news was a reminder that the biggest open problems aren't all in AI labs. Some are in the dirt, and some are 1.2 billion kilometers away.
All right, last stretch. We'll close with the human stories, and we'll take them in order of weight.
Gloria Steinem died at 92 in New York City. Feminist, journalist, author of 9 books, activist from the 1962 onward.
The reflections in the discussion centered on the span of that life. Active since the 60s means she was organizing across effectively the entire modern history of the feminist movement, through eras when the ideas she carried were marginal, then contested, then mainstream, and contested again. 9 books alongside decades of journalism and organizing. The tone was respect for longevity in a line of work where most people burn out or bow out.
Also today, workers at the New York Times and The Athletic, through the News Guild, voted unanimously to demand the company cancel its partnership with Kalshi, the prediction market.
The unanimity is the detail people flagged. Votes like this are rarely unanimous. There's almost always a handful of holdouts. A completely unified vote says the objection isn't a faction within the newsroom. It's the room. The substance of the objection: newsrooms are in the business of reporting on events, and prediction markets are in the business of monetizing outcomes of those events. When your employer partners with a market that trades on things you cover, the commenter saw a collision between editorial independence and a commercial arrangement, whether or not any individual journalist is affected.
What happens next is genuinely open. The workers have voted and demanded. The decision sits with management. Nobody in the discussion pretended to know which way the company goes, but everyone agreed the unanimity makes it harder to treat the objection as a minority complaint.
And a story about the fragility of digital identity that pairs oddly well with everything we've said today about platforms and accounts. ICANN has approved the destruction of third-level domains under .name. About 22,000 users, including Neil Fraser, who wrote about it, lose their sites, email, and services in February.
22,000 people. And the cruelty of it is in the details. They think all the passage will speak no is with the Sabre side. Name third-level domains were legitimate registrations. People built lives on them. Personal sites, email addresses, in some cases services. Those addresses are going into the ground in February because a policy decision upstream said so.
Neil Fraser's write-up got a lot of attention because it made the abstraction concrete. When a top-level domain gets restructured, the loss isn't statistical. It's a person whose email of many years simply stops. And the comment section connected it to a running fear. Most of us lease our identities from registries, registrars, and platforms, and the lease can be terminated by parties we've never interacted with. Between anti-gravity suspension terms earlier and this, the same lesson showed up twice from opposite directions.
The practical takeaway people offered: own a domain you control outright. Diversify where your critical addresses live, and assume nothing online is permanent by default. Grim, but the dename story is the proof of concept.
Let's end lighter, because we've earned it. Two things. First, a site called Any Human Ever randomly draws one life from among the more than 100 billion humans who have ever existed, using real demographic data.
The design constraint is what makes it work. It's not a fantasy generator. The lives it draws are weighted by real historical demography, which means if you hit the button, you are overwhelmingly likely to get a life that was short, rural, and pre-industrial, because that's what most human lives have been. The people discussing it said it produces a kind of vertigo that no history book quite manages. The sheer statistical improbability of being alive now, in this slice of conditions, versus anywhere else in the species ledger.
And second, for everyone who just felt old, Audacity 4.0 is out with a fully rebuilt interface on Qt 6, a new clip editing model, workspaces, and light, dark, and high contrast themes.
The affection for Audacity in the discussion was palpable. It's one of those tools people have used for 2 decades. The redesign was received as overdue rather than risky. The old interface was functional but creaky, and a new clip editing model plus workspaces brings it in line with modern audio workflows. High contrast theme as a first-class option got a specific nod from users with accessibility needs.
And that's a good place to land. A model that saturates benchmarks, an internet that briefly fell over, billions moving in OpenAI, agents with awkward incentives, polygons on Saturn, beavers outperforming engineers, a feminist legacy of 9 books and 60 years of work, and a website that reminds you that you, specifically, are a statistical miracle.
The through line, if there is one, systems, technical, natural, social, are all being rearranged at once, and the interesting work is figuring out which changes are structural and which are just weather. Thanks for listening, everyone.
We'll be back tomorrow. Take care.